everyone. This is your co-host, Stu, and I'm here with the paranormalist, Patty Wilson. Hi, Patty. How are you?
I'm fine, Stu. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, and I'm using my new mug that Mrs. Stu got me for Christmas, and it's huge. It holds a lot of coffee, and so when people ask me how many coffees I drink a day, I used to say 10 to 12. Now I can just say 5 or 6.
Wow. Because
it holds twice the amount. Yeah. So.
That, I figured. Mm-hmm. It couldn't have been anything but.
Yep. So, yeah, enough about my coffee habits. And so hopefully we're going to have an episode that's a little lighter than the last one. Last one was kind of heavy.
It was. It was very weird and creepy, but it was like, I just thought it was an interesting episode.
Oh,
but this one is
me too. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did you? This one is, it's about angelic visitations. And I know we've done episodes on it in the past, but it's one of my favorite topics. And I hear a lot of really good input from our listeners about him. People saying how it makes them feel good or feel better and stuff. And I just found some really amazing stories and I wanted to share them with everybody. So
please consider clicking the like or subscribe button that's down below. And you also find in the description of this video, everything related to the Paranormalist podcast, the Facebook groups, email address, and all of the associated other things with it, including Patty's books on Amazon. So thank you. And here we go with the episode.
Okay. So the first story I wanted to share tonight was kind of special to me. So Flight 93's crash site is a place, you know, from here in Pennsylvania. It's only 45 minutes from my house, and I've been there. I've had some emotional experiences and some odd experiences in that general vicinity, and I've heard so many stories, and I wrote about it, about the first one. Well, I guess he was not the first, but one of the security guards there who had some paranormal experiences. So I've always been fascinated with the Flight 93. And this is a story that actually touches on that. And I wanted to share it. The lady's name was Lily Leonardi, and she was an FBI agent. She had been at Ground Zero on September the 11th. And due to that, she would eventually retire from PTSD, which is more than understandable. But right as this all was going on, like I said, she had been there. She was then sent down to the Flight 93 original crash site where the actual crash happened. And people may not realize it, but it got moved around a little bit. Like they wouldn't let you down in to where it really happened at the beginning and what have you. So she was sent to the site in Pennsylvania. And this is what she has said she saw there. And she has testified to this on multiple occasions. And I just found it amazing. She said she got to the site just 3 hours after the crash. And she was struck by several elements. She was so startled by what she saw there that she kept it to herself for a little while, not sure of how her co-workers would treat her if they knew what she saw. And this is what she described. She said, I started seeing shimmering lights at the crash site, and it was kind of misty, and that's when I first saw the angels there. I didn't say anything to the guys because you can imagine if I would have. If I'd have said, I just saw angels at the crash site, they'd have called the office and said, she's lost her mind and she needs to go home. But they were dressed as if they were in warrior garb, like in a Roman centurion. There were so many of them, you couldn't see their faces. She said that she continued to see these flickers of light, each angel guarding the crash site. Her hope in sharing her story is that people will know that God was present on 9/11. And she walked away from it, wrote about it in her journals, eventually would tell a friend. And when she retired, she decided that she wanted to share that so that the families of the victims of all the different places where the impact was on that day would know that their family members were not forgotten and that the angels were there to protect them. And I just thought that was a very poignant and beautiful story, and I wanted to share it. And, you know, with her background and her keen observation skills, I mean, that's what she was trained to do. She makes a very compelling witness. So I wanted to share that story. I thought that was really interesting. And I'm not going to tell you a lot about angels today. I'm just telling you the stories of people who've encountered them. Because to me, that's really where the power in these stories lies, is in individuals who are not expecting to have an experience or having something happen that is just beyond their ability to explain. So this next story comes from a pastor. His name was John Boston, and he was driving down a road whenever a vehicle veered across the center line and came at him. The pastor tried to miss the car that was coming in his direction, and he hit a telephone pole. When he did, the transformer that was above it crashed into his car, literally fell down on top of the car. And then, you know, everything buckled, the intense heat from thousands of volts of electricity shooting out of this thing. And in the car was his four-year-old daughter with him. And they were trapped, and the car caught fire. The seatbelt would not open for him, and he could not get the door to open on her side. He couldn't get her out. That's when, to him, an angel came. He said that's when a scruffy man came out of nowhere, and he opened the door that was smashed and bent. The man removed him first from the car, and then the girl, and didn't seem to have any problems. He said he walked away about 20 feet from the vehicle to safety, and that's whenever the car exploded. And the man said to him, "My name is Johnny. The police are almost here. I can't be here when they get here, but you're going to be okay now." And then the man vanished in front of him. He said people have tried to rationalize the situation, saying, "I hit my head," that maybe Johnny was, if he was real, was just a guy with a bad past. However, the firefighters told me later that some of the things they saw at the crash site made no sense. For example, how the bent door that should have had to have been opened through the jaws of life was opened by a single man. How the seatbelt was unlatched despite the fact it was so badly bent they couldn't get it put back together. And he goes on and on with these different things. And he said, "I truly believe that I encountered an angel that day. He came to rescue my daughter and I." And then when his service was no longer needed, he went away. And how did he know the police were on their way? How did he know the paramedics were coming? You know, who did he call them? How did he know all of this? So, you know, when you think about it, there are a lot more questions than answers in that story. The next story was told by a young man who, when he was 7 years old, his best friend and his cousin died of cancer. And the family was very close. And during those 5 years of the little boy's life, his family and this little boy's family were very, very tight. So this was his best friend as well as his cousin. And after his cousin passed away, who was only a five-year-old little fella at the time of his death, he said, "My family continued to go and visit. And whenever the little boy had been alive, we used to go out and sit on the swings and play and talk all the time." So right after this little fellow passed away, the family went over to visit, and he was taken along, of course, as one of their kids. And he gets to the house, and he doesn't want to stay inside, and he says, "Can I go out and sit on the swings?" And he said, "I did that because it was like the last place I remember laughing with him." And he said, "I'm sitting there on the swings, and I'm thinking about my cousin and how things used to be, and that we'll never get to do that again. And all of a sudden, across the yard, I saw somebody coming. And there were two people. There was a little boy, and there was a man holding his hand. And as they got closer, I realized it was my cousin. And the other being was dressed in a gown, and it was an angel. It was a male angel." And he said the angel had the most beautiful blonde hair, and he was dressed all in a white gown. He never said a word, but he smiled at me sweetly. My cousin looked at me and he said, "Tell my mommy I'm not in pain no more." And then he turned around with the angel and walked away, and they simply faded into a door of light. And I wanted to cry. I love that little story because the, you know, death didn't win. This child is safe. And I just love that story. And I don't know how you refute something like that. And if there's any reason why you would even consider it. So I really, really thought this was a great story. There's a doctor by the name of Dr. Oski, O-S-K-I, Oski, who when he was in residency, he bought the science and you died. Whenever you die, your body just rots and there's nothing left and there's no soul, the whole nine yards. He was, they're taught that to a large extent in medical schools. They're not taught to believe in soul and spirit and those things. So he had kind of bought that whole storyline until one day he was in a patient's room and the patient was dying. And this is his story. He said he was in this room when a light as bright as the sun appeared, and out of it stepped an angel. He said, the angel looked at him and said to him, not to worry about her, the patient, that life is an endless cycle of improvements and that humans are not perfect yet. The angel said, most people learn this when they die, but handicapped children often know this, and that's why they can endure their pain without complaining, because they know their burden will pass soon. And some of the children even return as teachers for the rest of us to teach us how to love like that. And he said, I was so amazed by what I was hearing from this angel that I felt compelled to write about my experience. I was in the room with a 10-year-old child who was mentally handicapped, who was dying. And I looked at her face and I knew she was my teacher. I was not her doctor. I loved it. I'm just, as a person who has done, you know, end-of-life care for people, I related to that story so well.
There's a YouTube channel that I look at occasionally about the hospice worker. And you know, some of the stories she has are also, as incredulous as they may sound, they're just so uplifting to hear, you know, of a similar nature. Yeah.
No, I've read some really amazing books written by doctors who started out their journey, as I said, rather skeptical of the soul and survival of death. And one in particular is of a doctor who ended up volunteering in a hospice program. And, you know, he was very young, 26, 27 years old, whenever he volunteered and thought it was going to do for a year or two, kind of helped to harden him on death. And they actually, frankly, needed doctors really badly in the program. It's not exactly a high profit model area of medical care. So it doesn't get a lot of attention. You know what I'm saying? And he wanted to do that for them. And he tells the most amazing stories of loved ones appearing and, you know, people saying things to him like, I saw my husband last night, doctor. I'm pretty sure I'm going to die today or tomorrow. I just wanted to thank you for everything you've done for me. He told me he'll be the one to come with and take me home. So you don't have to worry about me anymore. Stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he said at first he just thought it was interesting. And then he would talk to families and they would give him details of things that even the dying person didn't know. Like, for example, that a family member had passed away and they didn't tell her because she was dying and they thought it was just too much stress. And then saying, you know, having that person say, well, you know, I don't understand how my aunt Aunt Louise showed up last night, but she was here and she told me she's died and it's okay. And she's coming back to get me in a couple of days. And the family's like, no, we never told her because we didn't want to stress her out anymore. Mm-hmm. So there were so many of those stories. And he talked about, like, he's still doing it 30 years later. So obviously it became his niche in the world. And he, this entire book of these amazing stories, some very poignant, some very sad, some very uplifting.
Yeah, you're going to think less of me for this, but when you started saying that it wasn't a very lucrative thing to get into, I'm thinking, like, well, the malpractice insurance can't be that high for that.
No, I'm not going to think less of you. But it's, you know, it's realistically, I mean, there are some areas in medicine where you can make a lot of money. And this just isn't one of them. So a lot of doctors don't focus on end of life. You can't win. So it isn't like, you know, you're going to go into this because you're going to beat death, because you're not. You just want to give them comfort while they are going through this process. And it's the same for, you know, doing end of life care as a CNA or a nurse or what have you. It's the people that I've ever encountered doing it are mostly very passionate. Because it's not an arena where you're going to make a lot of money. You're going to get a lot of glitz and glam, and you know, nobody's TikTok nursing you. You're just quietly going on doing the thing that you need to do for these people. It's a really interesting group of people, and they're dedicated in ways that I can't even begin to explain. But so that was, you know, that was why I chose to say it the way I did, because a lot of times you just get older doctors that are getting ready to retire or young doctors that are coming into it and they need some experience, and that he stayed a lifetime just touched my heart. It's a long time, 30 some years. It is. So I'm going to, we'll move on to a new story. So this story took place in the 1960s. This was a family, there's a set of older brothers and a little baby girl. And the family's just driving their car one evening whenever there's an accident with another car. And the little baby girl is, back in the 60s, we didn't have seatbelts, or they had them, but we didn't use them at all, you know? So when the cars collided, the little girl was thrown forward through the windshield. And she went through, out, her head went out and then went back in. So she was badly mangled and cut up. And the boys were in the back seat crying. Their dad was telling them, don't be afraid, don't be afraid. And he's holding his baby girl and his wife is screaming. And she's not dead. The little girl's not dead. And he's praying because he doesn't know what else to do. I mean, we didn't have cell phones either in the 60s. So you didn't grab a phone to call a paramedic. You didn't know what to do. You were hoping somebody else would go to a house down the street and do that for you. And you just prayed that somebody would. So he's praying over the baby to keep her alive. And other drivers stopped and somebody said, I'm going to go get assistance. I'll be back. And third car stops. And it was an older gentleman, and he had a doctor's bag, and he gets out of the car real quickly. And he said, step aside. I know how to take care of this. And he gets everybody to back up, and he takes the little girl in his arms, and he quickly bandages her little face, talks to her, calms her down. She's, you know, she's bleeding, but he's got her stable at this point. And the police come up, and dad gets out of the car, and he's talking to the police, and he's saying, you know, there's a doctor over here with our baby. We need to get the baby to the hospital, blah, blah, blah. And the police look, and the baby's laying there on the ground outside the car. And she's obviously been very well bandaged, but there's no doctor. And the people that are watching, you know, the pedestrians and the people that stop to help, their police go over and they go, where did the doctor go? And they're like, what doctor? And they're like, the doctor, somebody obviously gave medical aid to this child. They're like, oh, I didn't see a doctor. And the dad's like, no, he was an old guy. He was driving and he tells him the car and blah, 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 you know, and all this. And nobody else saw it. Nobody. And they get to the hospital And in the emergency room, the doctors say, who did this bandaging job on this baby? It's absolutely amazing. It saved her life. Whoever this doctor was, he was highly trained. And the dad attempted to find out who the doctor was. He said, you know, he never was able to make any headway. Nobody saw the doctor. Nobody saw the car. Nobody saw any of it. But they obviously had the baby, and they could see the baby had medical care. And she healed so well that there were no scars, except for one little tiny scar up near her hairline. And the family believes to this day that an angel came because the father was praying and they were in a really bad place. And he pushed through and he did the job that needed done to protect the baby, to get her to the hospital. And nobody was ever able to identify who he was, where he came from, where he went. In fact, nobody had any clue what he was talking about, which you see a lot of those kind of stories. Next story is also sort of along those lines. So this was about a young person who was driving from the horse stables, you know, and they were headed back home whenever a car turned in front of them, ran a stop sign, and hit them on the driver's side. And the door jammed. There was no way to get it open. The person was trapped inside, panicking. She was screaming for help and didn't know what to do. She couldn't get the seatbelt off to get across to the passenger side to climb out that way. Cars start pulling up, and she was just trapped. She couldn't get out. And she heard someone yell, "I can't get the door open." And that's when she thought, "I'm going to die in this car. I'm going to die in this car." And she said, "The next thing I remember, I was somehow out of the car. I was on the road standing by myself. I looked up and I saw a shadow at the front of the car. It was the front part of a man from the side. And I turned to the driver of the other car, which had stopped. He was injured, but not seriously." And she said, "I didn't know who he was at the time. And I said, 'I don't know how you got me out of the car.' And the man looked and said, 'I didn't. You were just suddenly standing here.'" And that's when she said, "I realized that I'm somehow moved through the car door with supernatural help. The door was still wedged shut on both sides." And she said, all I could think of at that moment was Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, how they were thrown into a fire and they were not burnt. If God could do that, he could certainly pick me up and move me through a car door." And for the rest of her life, this lady has believed that that's exactly what occurred to her. And I wanted to share a story about a little girl who had leukemia. She's about 11 years old. She had leukemia. Her name was Erin Potter. This is a very well-known story. In about 2007, she was going through cancer for the third time. So she'd had it, beat it as a small child, had it, beat it, came back third time. And she was looking at having to do another bone marrow transplant. She would go outside and play in the evening with her sparklers, and she liked to wave them and watch them in this, you know, in the nighttime light. And her mom was documenting everything just in case this time she didn't beat it again. So she would take her camera out and go and take a bunch of pictures. And on this one particular night, she was out there and she's watching her daughter and she's taking photographs of her daughter. And she didn't see anything unusual. She didn't question it. A couple days later, she went and picked up the film at the local pharmacy. And she's flipping through the pictures, looking at them. And she said that what she saw was an angelic figure watching over her child. You could see the shape of the figure. You could see the ruffle of the wings. And it was standing just behind her child. There was no one there. There was nothing there at the time. It's not in, it doesn't appear in the photo before or the photos after, only in that one frame. And she said, I knew at that moment that Erin was going to survive, that she was going to be cancer free. I knew that that was why the angel came, to keep an eye on her and to help her through this. And the photograph does exist, and you can look it up. It is there. Again, the child's name was Erin, E-R-I-N, Potter. And it's just a picture of what looks like a little girl playing with the sparklers and then this being behind her. I'm looking at it right now. And I you know, I truly believe that for reasons like that, angels do come. One more such story. A little girl by the name of Chelsea Banton, who was 14, was suffering from multiple issues, disabilities and issues, and she was in and out of the hospital all the time. She had pneumonia, and then once you get pneumonia, it scars your lungs and you're more susceptible to it. So she kept getting sick with pneumonia over and over again. And eventually, the doctors told her mother that she wasn't going to make it, that it was just painful to let her continue to struggle and suffer, and she wasn't going to get past the pneumonia this time. So her mother made a really difficult decision and decided to have them pull the plug and take her off life support. Hours after this happened, Chelsea was still alive. And there was a nurse at the nursing station who, as part of her duties, she would get watch the monitors. And she noticed a man standing outside of Chelsea's room. She thought it was kind of odd because she didn't recognize him. And as Chelsea had been in and out of that particular unit multiple times, she pretty much knew all Chelsea's family and friends who came to visit. So she decides to go down the hallway and check and see what the man was there for and if he needed some assistance. Because he was just standing outside the door looking into Chelsea's room. So she goes down the hallway and he's not there. She goes back to the nurse's station and she looks at the monitor and he's there. She looks down the hallway, he's not there. So finally she says to a couple of the nurses, this is the strangest thing I've ever seen. And she shows them the man on the monitor and they're like, yeah, there's a guy on the monitor looking in Chelsea's room. Why? She's like, look down the hallway. They look, he's not there. And they're puzzled. There's like four or five of the nurses, a couple of the techs. They're all kind of gathered around the monitor. And then somebody says, look at Chelsea's heart monitor. And they all looked expecting that, you know, it's going down. Things are shutting down like they should have been. And instead, her heart rate's picking up. And her vitals are beginning to get better. And they're looking at this and somebody says, we got to go down and check on her. And they break away and go on down the hall. There's nobody there. They see the nurse go into the room on the monitor. They see her go past the man, but the nurse who went in didn't see the man. And Chelsea would survive. In fact, over that night, Chelsea was healed and her life was saved. The nursing staff was so amazed by what happened. They shared it with the family the next day, with the doctors, despite the fact they were told by the hospital not to. And eventually the story would get out. And what's interesting is one of them had the presence of mind to clip a frame from that area, from that room, and you see a being of white light standing in the doorway of Chelsea's room. The photograph is there. You can look it up. It is really interesting. And for those who have listened to my stories before and knows about me talking about the spirit at Hillview, it appears almost identical to that. So I found that story really interesting because whoever he was, it was a fascinating photograph. So if you get a chance to look it up, Take a look at it. It's just a being of light. You can see it's a human shape, the brightest white light you could possibly imagine. And of course, the family attributes this being with her miraculous healing whenever the doctors had told them she was going to die. So our next story is about a pastor by the name of Michael Cleary. Now, he's not the person to whom this happened. Michael Cleary was going down the highway one night when he saw a car accident in front of him. A gentleman by the name of Mr. Wooten was ejected from his car and thrown into a ravine. And so the pastor, you know, saw what was going on, and he hurries down over the hill embankment to where the body of this man is, and he's trying to render aid. At that point, there's somebody else that yelled, "I'm calling for help." And he said, you could clearly see this gentleman, Mr. Wooten, laying on his chest and his, you know, he's face down in the gully. And he said, he rendered aid as best he could. He didn't want to move the body because, you know, he wasn't sure what damage he might do. The man was unconscious, so he just sort of stayed there with him until the paramedics arrived, at which point he stepped back up into the highway, standing there kind of praying over the whole situation. And he decided to take a photograph. He said, I don't know why. It wasn't like it was something I was going to like publicly show or anything like that. But he said, I just decided I needed to take this picture. And he snapped a shot and then got back in his car and took off. Later on, he looked at the picture and thought, you know, that's so not like me. I shouldn't have done that. I need to get rid of it. And as he pulls it up to get rid of it, he realizes there's an angel sitting in the tree on a branch right above this Mr. Wooten. And it's as though it's this being is looking down upon him, and you can see him on the ground. You can see the vehicle that had, you know, gone through there. You see the paramedics working on him, and you can see the angel sitting in the tree. And then he said, I knew why I needed to take that photograph. I didn't know at the time, but it was needed for later. And I love that story, and the picture is there. So I chose some stories where you could actually go and look up the stories, you know, and look at the photos, because some, I always hear people say things like, well, you know, well, you've said it before, you know, we have a whole video camera and all this stuff on our phones these days. Why don't we ever catch this stuff? And the truth is we do. They just don't publish it very often.
And what this particular story made me think of, so the picture taker, the pastor, didn't notice anything out of the ordinary. You think if there was an angel sitting in a tree, you'd see that. You think you would, especially if you took a picture and you didn't see anything out of the ordinary. But then when you looked at the picture, so did this being, this angelic being, say, I don't want you to see me with your own eyes, but I don't mind being photographed?
I don't know. I know, like, when I took the pictures at Hillview, mm-hmm. I knew it was there because I could see it in my mind's eye, okay? Mm-hmm. But nobody else could see it. But they sensed there was something there. Like I've said about the one lady sitting there crying, and she kept saying, what am I missing? What am I missing? I've waited my lifetime for this. I just know it. What am I missing? And I didn't know anything about what she was talking about at that moment in time. And whenever I looked at, I didn't see the bright light when he disappeared. But when you look at the photos, you can see it. And it's extremely bright white, and it reflects off the floor. So it had mass at the time. Mm-hmm. I know, I think I've sent that to you, so I know you've seen it.
You did, yeah. And I find that whole thing, even with ghosts, that you can't see, or other spirit that you cannot see with the naked eye, but yet photographic equipment picks it up, both film photography and digital photography, which relies on the same light waves that we see with our own eyes. I mean, yes, a modern video camera is going to see a little bit more outside of the spectrum of light that we see, but not that much, unless you have like a full spectrum camera. But here, this is just, you know, I'm assuming a cell phone camera.
Yeah, no, that's what it was. It was a cell phone camera from the early 2000s. So it wasn't like really super, super high tech.
So what is it that, so to me, that's a conscious decision by the angel to not be seen by the naked eye, but be allowed to be photographed. Yeah, I just find that part fascinating. I mean, there's no answer, I don't think. But yeah. I just find that to be quite a same with the gentleman standing in the hallway of Chelsea's hospital room. You can see me on the camera, but you can't see me for real. You know, that's...
Yeah, and you hear those stories, like you said, about ghosts as well. I mean, I could tell you a half a dozen stories that come to mind where, like, somebody looked in a rearview mirror and the ghost is there, and they turn around and they look into the back of their car, it's not there. Or, you know, again, a mirror of some sort. It's a reflective thing, but whenever they look with the direct eye, they can't see it. I don't know why. I don't know if it has anything to do with frequencies of light or if it's there's somehow inhibiting our ability to do it. I'm not sure, but it happens. And but I just thought that was such an interesting story because I got it because I had that same compulsion when I was at Hillview to take those pictures. Like everybody else was taking pictures. And like normally I would have said, oh, there's no sense in me taking a bunch of pictures. They've got it covered. But I only took two. Hold up my phone, click, click, done. And then I was busy focusing on everything else going on around me. And everybody else is looking at their photos at the end. And Jaffa pulls up my hand and she says, you took pictures. What did you get? And I'm like, I don't know. And I handed her the phone and she looked and she's like, oh my gosh, Patty, look at this. And that's when we saw it right there in the room at that time, which also was, I think, helpful because had it been at a later date or at a different place where we discovered it, there was always that argument that maybe somehow it was manipulated, but they were all in the room watching at the time it happened. So my next story is about an answer to prayer. And I am a big person to believe in the answers to prayer. I don't think we always get the answers we think we're going to get or the ones that we think we need, but we get an answer. And I've had stories of this sort happen in my life 1,000 times and people I've known. Because I grew up in a world where there were domestic missions and people who seeded churches, which means you basically go in with absolutely no money and you try to start a church. And so it's definitely, again, not a lucrative thing. You literally were working a physical job and trying to start a church for a denomination and not getting paid for it. People do this because they do it out of passion. They don't do it because they're going to make themselves rich. You are never rich when you do it. My mother's best friends when I was a kid growing up was a gentleman was an engineer and his wife, and he gave up a job as an engineer to become a pastor. And he gave up that to become the guy that seeded about 12.5 churches. So they were always literally dirt poor, hand to mouth. And I saw 100 different times when something amazing happened, like they were starting a church in a particular area. They had no place to live and no money. And this manufactured housing place called and said, hey, we heard you're starting up a church in this area. If you guys have a place to park it, we'll give you a mobile home. And I mean like a nice mobile home, like a $70,000 back in the 1980s mobile home.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, and they're like, yeah, we just have a little piece of ground out here by the church. And they're like, great. Let us know when we can move it in. And they're like, we can't afford it. And he's like, no. I feel compelled to just donate this. And I saw that. And to this day, I think about it still sometimes. I was about 17 when that happened. And, you know, they had no place to live. They were literally living in a van. 3 kids, him and her. And he was working a day job and in the evenings trying to turn his old house into a church. And they had no clue what they were going to do. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, this guy calls them up and says, I'm giving you a house. So I believe in these stories because I've seen them happen. And this is about a young woman who's talking about her family. Her parents were ministers in England, and they were seeding churches. I mean, she doesn't use that term, but that's basically what they were doing. So they didn't have much money. And she said her mother was very worried, and because funds were so very tight. They didn't have money for food. They didn't have money for light bills. They didn't have money for just normal, you know, stuff that normal people would have to do day to day, month to month, you know, pay your utilities and things. And so she was very, very worried, and she was praying, because there aren't any wages when you're starting a church. There's just nothing. And you live off of people donating money and donating help and donating everything. So she's praying about all this, her mother. And she said, my mother said to us, don't worry, kids. It's going to be okay. God's going to take care of us. He always does. And she said, literally 30 seconds later, there was a knock on the door. And a woman was standing there, and she said, are you Mrs. So-and-so? And she said, yes, I am. And she said, a friend of mine wanted me to give you this envelope. And I don't know what's in it, but I just felt compelled to stop right now and give it to you. And so she did. And she said the girl came, handed us the envelope, and then was gone. And my mother opened the envelope, standing on the porch, still watching the young lady walking down the street. And it was money. It was a significant amount of money that somebody had donated. And my mother looked up, and there was no place to go. There were not a lot of houses in this area. So there was a lot of empty vacant lots. And literally, she should have been walking down the sidewalk, and she was just gone. She's like, there was no car. There was nowhere for her to go. No houses she could have ducked into. And my mom walked down the street and looked for her and could not find her anywhere. And when she reached out to this person, the person said woman had said had wanted her to drop the money off. They said, oh, we were talking about wishing we had the money to give to you. We feel bad for the way things have been for you guys lately, but we didn't have the money. So in no way, you know, where did it come from? And like I said, I have seen that 1,000 times over the course of my life, where I tell the story about the shoe money, you know, like we didn't have any money when my middle boy was to start school, and none at all, like nothing. I couldn't even afford a pair of shoes for him to go to school, and his sneakers were, you know, all worn out and what have you. And I felt so terrible. I was a terrible mom because I couldn't afford to buy him a new pair of shoes and a couple new outfits for school, for kindergarten. And I was just like devastated, didn't have any prospects. I mean, I was working, but it was just barely enough to keep body and soul together for the three of us. And went into the post office, and there was this check from someplace I had dropped off books like a year earlier and had completely forgotten about it. And it was just a check for like a couple $100s. And I remember coming out of the post office, and I'm crying, and the kids are looking at me, and they're like, why are you crying, mommy? And I'm like, we have shoe money now. And every time I got money from the books from that point forward, they called it the shoe money.
Shoe money.
But I mean, like, it would have been forever since I had sent those books there, and I had completely forgotten. And there they were on the day when we needed money the most. And we went and got him shoes and a couple outfits and some extra groceries, and we made it through. And I'm telling you, more times than I could ever explain to everybody, that has happened to me. And so I'm a big believer that God helps you. Like, I would be in a position where I would be like, God, I don't know what to do now. I'm really lost. And boom, something would happen. So I loved that story because it was so pretty. And I get it. It's an amazing feeling when something comes out of nothing like that, and you know you got your prayers were heard. I'm going to tell another story about a doctor. So this is a mysterious doctor's name of the story. This lady tells the story about, she was in the hospital for biopsy and something went wrong, and the doctors were very concerned. And so they decided that she needed to stay, and they weren't giving her answers. You know how doctors can double speak you and tell you something, but it doesn't make any sense and it doesn't really answer the question? And they weren't admitting to her that they had made a mistake. And that's what had put her in that position.
Okay.
So she's in the hospital and these doctors are coming and they're going and then they're trying to figure out what to do because they made a mistake and it was, you know, and this old doctor comes in and he sits down with her and he's talking to her. And she said she just felt very comforted by him. And he answered her questions clearly. And he left and other doctors came in and then he came back in later on that night. And he told her that, you know, I wanted to let you know that everything's okay. You're going to be fine. Somebody here made a mistake and everybody's in a bit of a panic and an uproar, but it's all going to be all right. So the doctors, they come in the next day with a specialist and he's trying to talk to her about, you know, doing the gobbledygook thing or where you kind of dance around the truth. And she says, look, I talked to the doctor the night before and she tells him exactly what they did wrong, how they made this mistake and what needs to be done to fix it. And he's like, who did you talk to? And she named the doctor and they're like, who did you talk to? And she describes him. And they're like, there is no doctor who works here by that name. She said, well, there's got to be because I talked to him twice yesterday. He told me everything. And they went out and talked to the nurse, looked at the roster for the day before, came back in and they said, there is no such doctor. I don't know who you spoke with, but it wasn't one of our doctors. And she said that's when it dawned on her that God had put this angel there to explain it all to her, to give her some peace, because they were telling her some terrible things were going to happen. And, well, God knew that wasn't how it was going to end. And I thought that was really interesting. And then I came across a little bit of a trend, and I didn't anticipate it. I was like, I would say I'm 60 years old. I've been doing collecting stories my whole life. But I suddenly, and I, you know, so I think I would notice most trends, but this is new. So I'm going to call them man in a suit stories, because that's exactly what they were. And these are man in a suit stories. And so the story takes place, the first one in 1994. It was these two young women who ended up in India, and they were Americans, so they spoke only English. They got twisted up coming home from an event. They were staying in India for about 6 months for a work-study program, and they get off the train at the wrong spot, and it's a really hanky area. It's the middle of the night. There's people, you know, very rude looking, coarse looking people yelling at them. People are jostling towards them, trying to yell at them. They have no clue what anybody's saying. Not a single soul seems to speak English. They're getting frightened. They're just, you know, 19, 20 year old girls. And none of them seemed to know when they kept asking, you know, how do we get to this place? How do we get back onto the train? How do we get there? How do we get to where our house is at? And people just looked at them and they began to get very frightened because it was a rough looking spot. And that's when this tall gentleman in a suit came out of nowhere. And he's carrying a briefcase and he walks right up on them. And they felt fairly calm. And his first words were, I know exactly how to get you home to where your hospital is. That's where they were working at a hospital. And they followed him. They did exactly what he said. He went over, he talked to one of the rickshaw drivers. He gave them directions. And he said, hold on. And he went and he talked to somebody else. And he said, this man, I've paid him to be your guard for the journey. He will keep you safe until you get home. He'll make sure you get to where you need to go. They're shocked. The rickshaw driver's just been paid. This guard out of nowhere, you know, has just been paid. And the girls, they reach out and to take his hand and say, thank you. And he's not there. And, you know, they really couldn't speak to anybody to ask them, but they said he just wasn't there. But the guy, they didn't have the money to pay for the rickshaw driver. They didn't have the money to pay for the guard. All of this was already prepaid for, and nobody seemed to know what they were talking about. And that's why I said there's a trend to this, because then I came across this, The Man in a Suit, London. And this one starts out with about 20 years ago. So, it would, you know, this lady was breaking up with her boyfriend. Everything was really, really rough. And she was struggling. She was running late for meetings, and she got into a car she had rented and was headed up through London. She was in a bad area whenever the tire blew. She doesn't know how to change a tire. She's just a young lady, and she doesn't know how to get out of this area. She doesn't know who to call. It starts to rain, and traffic's getting crazy, and people are honking at her and yelling at her, and she's getting more flustered by the second. And she said all of a sudden, out of nowhere, a man appeared in a business suit, and he didn't say a word to her. He just went over to the back of the car, opened the car up, got the jack out, changed the tire. And she's like, I'm following him. And I'm like, thank you so much. I so appreciate it. He's nodding, never says a word, stands up. And she goes, he puts everything back in the back of the car that needs to be put away. And she's like tagging behind him, and he slams the hood. And she says, oh, thank you so much. And looks at him, and he's gone. And I came across about 7 stories like that through the course of doing the research on this particular episode, a visitor. So this young lady was working, and she said she was sitting at her desk. She was feeling really discouraged. She was struggling. She didn't know if she was making the right choices in life and all of this. And all of a sudden, the door opens to the business, and there's a whole bunch of other people in the business all sitting in their cubicles. They can all see each other. And this guy walks in, and he's a guy in a suit. He looks very well dressed. He walks straight up to her desk, and he knew her name. And he said, you know, I'm really proud of you. You know, you need to not worry. Don't let people make you question your faith. And he's talking to her, and he says, you've got this desire to go to Bible college. You need to fulfill that. Don't give up just because it's hard. And she's like, I'm just blown away who this crazy strange man is, and where did he come from? And how does he know all this stuff about me? Because she hadn't even talked to anybody about the Bible college idea. And everybody in the office is kind of watching this interchange. And she says, I don't understand. How do you know all this? And he grins at her, and he says, I think I should probably buy something. Isn't that the right thing to do right now? And she's like, I guess. And he said, what do you think I should buy? And she said, I honestly don't know. She's so, you know, overwhelmed by what's going on. And he goes, oh, okay. And he walks about 4 feet out through the room, turns around, and he smiles at her, and then he's just gone. Full view of everybody else there as well. And other people are like, where did he go? Who was he? What's he doing here? And she's like, that's whenever I heard this voice in my head say, he's your angel. And she said, that's exactly what I said. He's my angel. And I liked that story. I thought that was sweet. So we're going to travel to Bali, 1978. And it was a horrible flood going on at the time of this story. And this poor gentleman was, who is a native of Bali. He's trying to get home, but the flood has kind of kept everybody from traveling. Like, he's stuck. He's either going to have to hoof it or wait it out somewhere. And he decides he's going to hoof it. He gets to this one cross street area where the water is about waist high. And just as he thinks, I can wade through this, I'm pretty sure, he hears a voice above him scream. And he uses the Indonesian language, but I'm going to translate. And he also gives a translation. Watch out! He looks up. There's nobody there. It's just open sky, but he can hear a voice. And he said, then I realized there's a man sitting on a light pole. And he's looking at the guy on the light pole, and he's like, what the heck are you doing? And the guy says, there's a cable in the water. Get off. Get off the sidewalk there. And he looks at the guy, and he's like, oh, my gosh, I could have been electrocuted. And he looks at the water for a second, looks back up. The guy on the cable on the light pole is gone. He's like, there was nowhere for him to go. He couldn't have done anything other than come down the pole directly in front of me. And he said, I can't explain it in any way. Nobody else saw him. Nobody else heard him. I didn't see the cable in the water. I would have been electrocuted, but for that voice from that light pole that yelled, watch out. And he said, he also, you know, he said he spoke in Indonesian, a language I was really familiar with. And he's like, I can't explain it, but I think he was an angel. And I just thought that was really cool. So this one is about a group of kids. They were going to a music festival in England. And there's a block of bathrooms in this one area for everybody to use. These are young girls, or about 15-year-old girls. And there's about four of them. And they're at this big music festival. And, you know, there's all the movies or the music stars are there, and they're all excited. And they decide to go to the restroom. And as they're headed in that direction, they run into a group of young men who are drinking heavily. And the girls are, you know, obviously very young, very frail comparatively. And they start following the girls, which scares them half to death. And they go into the bathrooms. And that's when things get bad. These guys follow them into the bathrooms. The girls lock themselves into the cubicles. And the men are beating on the door, and they're screaming, you know, you got to come out. They're jerking at the doors. And they're terrified. These poor girls. There's nobody, you know, security, nobody to help them. And the music started up, so most people are out there watching the music again. They can hear it in the distance. And suddenly, out of nowhere, there's a voice, and it screams, get out of here, the police are coming. One of the girls peeks out, you know, a little crack between the door and the wall, and she sees a man standing in a business suit right in the middle of the room. The men are all looking at this fella, and they could have taken him. There was, you know, six or seven of them versus him. And all of a sudden, she said, we could see their faces, and they just turned around and walked away, all of them, as though they had been commanded. And she's like, we opened the door and wanted to tell him, thank you. And he didn't look at them. They were like, excuse us, who are you? You know, thank you so much and for helping us. And the man just smiled at him for a second. He stepped three more steps out from where he was standing to the doorway, pushed the door open, and they ran after him. They estimated less than 2 seconds, and he was gone. They ran directly into the arms of a security team member. They were telling him they were looking for the man in the suit who saved them. And he said, girls, you're the first ones to come by here in the last 15 minutes. Nobody walked by here. And as an adult, this woman tells the story, and she says, the only thing I can think of is that he was an angel and he came to help us. So there are literally hundreds of these stories. And if people want to hear more of them, be happy to share them. I have been collecting angel stories my whole life. I love them so much. They are my favorite type of story to tell, besides maybe a ghost story. And, I hope everybody's enjoyed them tonight, and I'm going to end them with this one here and that we just told. And if you want to hear more, let me know. I will happily share them with you. I hope you enjoy them. I hope they bring you peace and hope. I know they always do that for me. So with that, Stu, I wish you a good evening.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.